Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic classroom lectures in business and economics recorded for podcast. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2010. Lecture 3, delivered on January 19, 2010. The title of this lecture is Interest Rates.
Today, interest rates. To initiate this subject, I'm going to do something that doesn't sound like it has anything to do with interest rates. Have you ever had a cheeseburger, madam? Good. You look like you could use two cheeseburgers. Now, you go into Mabel's restaurant, and I'm Mabel. And you are young, and this is your first time in the restaurant, and Mabel says to you, well, hello there. I'd like to give you take your order now. What would you like? And you can say, I can have two cheeseburgers. Well, that's nice. And I'm going to fix your order up. Earl, two cheeseburgers for the lady. Charge you tax. Here you go. So two cheeseburgers, $3 each, and so you pay a bill of
$10. Well, I pay a bill of $6.
Good, yeah. Good. You worried me there for a minute.
I thought you meant
concentrate, woman. Last lecture, yeah, it was a T bill I paid. Okay, concentrate, woman. Okay. Now you've become a regular at the restaurant. 15 years later, you're still coming in there. Now the restaurant is old, and I'm older, but I'm still there. Well, there you are again. Every night you come in here, you need to find yourself a nice man instead of coming in here. All we got is truck drivers in here. This slob comes in, and he's looking at you. Don't even talk to that man. He's disgusting. I've heard things about. But anyway, so. I can't see what she orders. I can't see through the windows. But I do see that there, when she gets to the cash register, the bill is $12. Well, that could mean three different things. One is, it could mean that the cheeseburgers have gone up in price from $3 each to $6 each. On the other hand, it could mean that she's become a bigger woman. She eats more now. Four cheeseburgers you could be eating. That could be a $12 bill. Or it could mean that you're somewhat bigger, but the price has gone up to, what the hell, three. You know what I mean. Get off me, okay? Quit it. Let's not look at the intermediate scenario. My mind isn't working right now. Thinking about cheeseburgers, I'm hungry. The point of this is that, you see, to find out how much she pays, I would take the price times the quantity. Initially, it was pretty easy to see that I had a price of, what the hell was my price? Oh, $3 each. Don't get old. Kill yourself before you get to my age. And I had a quantity of two cheeseburgers. And that created a bill of $6. This isn't calculus. This is, and I'm not, it doesn't get much worse than that right here. There are a few places in this course where the quant gets busy, but this is, ride with me on this for a minute. Look, that $6 is what we call a nominal amount. Nominal because it's a name. Have you ever eaten $6?
No.
No. I recall one night I was drunk and I think I did eat a dollar bill, but don't remember much about it, thank God. Everyone else at the party did. But here's the deal. That's a named amount. That's a name we give. The cheeseburgers, that's real. Real food. That's the real thing, is that too. The $6 is just a name we give to it. And it's a name we give to it for a number of reasons. For one thing, that way we can compare different values of different foods. How can you compare two cheeseburgers to, oh, let's say, a Caesar salad? You can't really compare them. But if I give a value to each one, maybe a market price, then I see, I have more of a basis for comparison. That's why these nominal amounts are useful to us. How do I compare a car to a house? Well, once I have given the name, the money name to them, then I have at least some basis for comparison of relative value. So in this example, I talked about, well, a real number of cheeseburgers was 2. The price of each one was 3, so I can give a nominal value of $6. Knowing in the back of my mind that the real value was 2. The real value was 2. But then we went to this scenario where down the road 15 years, I had $12. And I saw that, and it was obvious that there could have been several different scenarios involved there. I could have still had a real value of 2 with a price of 6. That would have created the effect of a nominal value of 12. But I could have also had that they still could have been $3 each. And I could have had this woman, having turned into a hog, eat 4. I can't tell what the real value, the real is, by just stating the nominal. I can't do that. Just stating the nominal doesn't tell me anything about the real. It just doesn't. And underneath it, we really, really want to know if this woman has become a cheeseburger-aholic. And this is what we talk about in economics and in finance, is we have to understand that the world that we see, and especially the world of data that comes to us through information streams and the data that comes to us through our eyes, is usually nominal. It's a name. Behind the curtain is the real. And oftentimes, we can't see the real. All we see are the names. You can get into some very seriously weird stuff in mathematics and representation theory about perception and all that, which I won't get into here. But we have to recognize that the real does matter. We want to know about the real, but oftentimes the real is hidden behind a curtain where we can't see it. And we have to find ways to tease it out. Maybe to scale in some way to try to figure out a way that we can, just from seeing the 6 and the 12, know what happened behind the curtain, behind the dirty windows where we couldn't see it. Now, let me take this a little farther, a little closer to finance for you. When I say interest rate, I'm referring to some kind of a value. Now, you'll hear me use different terms. Yield is another fancy word. See, you're going to go to a finance singles bar. Now, if you say interest rate, the obvious prospective friends that you can make are going to think you're a loser. If you say yield, you will breed. Okay? Yield. But I'm talking about an interest rate. The discount rate. The yield. The interest rate. The rate of return. I'm talking about the same basic idea. Something that tells you about how much money you're making. And that's all the fancier I'll get with the concept for right now. But when I say, in this class, and you'll hear me say this, the interest rate. Well, you know as well as I do that there's more than one interest rate. If I say the interest rate went up, well, what interest rate are we talking about? different interest rates for different things. There's an interest rate on a loan for a car. There's an interest rate on a student loan. There's an interest rate you get when you invest your money in a CD. There's an interest rate that you pay get for money that you put in a savings account. There are all kinds of interest rates out there. The question that we begin with here is, how are all of those interest rates bound together? What is the common denominator of all interest rates? And unfortunately, the common denominator is what we call the real rate of return. The real rate of return. And just like other real things, the real rate of return is hidden behind a curtain where we cannot see it. But it's there. But it's there. And I'm going to write... I apologize. In the old days, we used R's, the letter R for an interest rate. These days, I've seen this for the last 10 years or so, they use K. So I'll try to stick with K. K, and you'll see me write a real, K sub real. Let me talk about this real interest rate for a minute. This is common. It is the substrate of all interest rates. Madam, hook me up with $100 for a year. Okay. I'll give you back $100 in a year, okay? Sound good deal to you?
No.
Capitalist running dog. Obviously, you're going to give up the use of $100 for a year. There's an opportunity cost in that to you. You could have done something else with that. You could have invested it somewhere else. But the most important thing you could have done is, do you like to shop?
Yes.
You could have shopped with it. You could have. You see, at the heart of all interest rates is this core interest rate, which represents the opportunity cost of foregone consumption, the opportunity cost of giving up your money. If you don't have your money, you can't spend your money. So at the end of the day, someone's going to have to reward you if you're going to give up that money. You don't look like a stupid person. You're not a sucker. You're not a sucker. You're not going to just give me $100, which means you don't have $100. You might need that $100. Who knows? There might be a sale at Kohl's. Hell, every day there's a sale at Kohl's. Have you ever noticed there's never not a sale at Kohl's? You know, it's Tuesday. We have a sale going on. One of my favorite comedians, Shecky Green, he said, it's President Johnson's birthday, so it is not. Okay, well, we'll have a sale of more, double the original sale then. You see, you can give up an interest, you can give up money, but you have to be rewarded for it. At least, I'm looking around this room. I think I could probably find a couple of people who would be marks who would let me use $100 for a year. Yeah. I think I could, but for the smartest of you, which is what we deal with in finances, the marginal economic agent, you're going to charge me for it because you could have done something else with it that would have benefited you. So at the end of the day, every interest rate has this underlying whisper called the real rate of return, which represents the opportunity cost of foregone consumption. The opportunity cost of foregone consumption. Now, this might be a small amount. I'm not going to represent to you that I can tell you right now what it is, because it is something we don't see. It's something that's there, but it's hidden behind the curtain because never is the real shown. Only the nominal is shown. And I'll address that in a minute. Now, you're going to see me attack this real interest rate in different ways. It's rather, it's a slippery pig because just when you think you've got your hands on it, this other piece slides in. It's difficult. What is the real interest rate? Well, historically, I could say maybe 0.5%, 1%, 1.5%. It actually moves around some. because of the abundance of money in the economy. But right now, interestingly enough, the Federal Reserve has been trying to salvage the economy from the absolute financial catastrophe that was largely its fault over a period of years. And so they poured so much money into the economy that money is so abundant that that real interest rate actually probably went negative, which is bizarre as hell. There is evidence that it went negative briefly during the Great Depression, but there's decent evidence now that the real interest rate went negative recently. How do I know that? Because apparently some nominal interest rates dropped negative recently. That's weird. But anyway, enough of that. Okay. Now I'm going to take you to the next part here. Okay. I'm your boss. You work for me. What should we do here? Think of something manly, man, that we could do as construction work. Yeah, and I hire you. You're a strapping, muscular guy, and you do your work for me. I pay you $8 an hour. And, okay, I'll pay you $10 an hour. Just because it actually turns out your mom and me, you're my son, but you don't know it. That's right. I am your father. Okay, here we go. Now, inflation was running last year about, well, let's say, 5%. Okay? It was running at 5% last year. Okay, so you come in, and it's your one-year review, and I say to you, okay, I think you've done a good job, so you can keep your job, and you'll keep your salary, your pay, $10 an hour, okay?
I'd want $10.50.
You ungrateful? I'm giving you a job. What? Are you telling me that you need to be rewarded for inflation just to stay even? Is that what you're telling me?
Stay even.
Yeah. Okay, never mind the fact that you're no more productive. Just to stay even with inflation, you would want a premium on your pay. Okay, now there's a little more to it than that, because it turns out that after you finish your construction job at night, you're going to college, and you are majoring in business. And you have studied the numbers, you work with numbers, you're in finance, you're in economics management, you're in the numbers game. You see that inflation went from 1% a couple of years ago to 3% 2 years ago to 5% last year. So is 5% really what would keep you even this year in your mind?
No.
You would want something a little more. You see, here's the thing. It's not historical inflation that would matter. That wouldn't matter at all. It is the expectation of inflation. So you say to me, I want an 8% increase. Well, I say to you, well, here, listen to me. I was just watching Fox News, and they said the government promises that inflation is going to go down. That's what they promised. The government promised it. I saw that president of ours. He got up there on TV, and he said, we are having the moral equivalent of war against inflation. Meow. Moral equivalent of war. Okay. That was, believe it or not, Jimmy Carter declared his fight on inflation the moral equivalent of war. Of course, it was a disgrace when people point out, that's meow. It really, but yeah, he said, we're going to fight inflation. Do you believe him?
Nope.
You see, it's the expectation. It's not the promise. It's not the hope. It's not holding hands and singing kumbaya. It is the expectation of the future that will drive your decision-making process. In finance, we are all about expectations. It doesn't matter what history has told us. All that matters is what we expect the future to be. That's all that matters, is the expectation. History is eaten. It's gone. It's with Jesus. All that matters to us is the expectation of the future. So when I talk about any kind of a value, a real value, on top of that, inextricably linked to it, is going to be an expectation of inflation. So when I talk about any interest rate that you could see with your eyes, or hear with your ears, or smell with your nose, it will not be the real interest rate. It will be this animal called the risk-free rate. It will start there with an expected inflation premium. The very lowest interest rate that would ever be observed would be this risk-free rate. It would be the real rate combined, intertwined with, infected by, an expected inflation premium. A short-term treasury bill is as riskless can get. It's not theoretically the risk-free rate, the yield on a T-bill. It's not theoretically, but it's as close as we could ever see. The risk-free rate, per se, is a theoretical thing. But in the real world, if you were to look at the yield on a T-bill, a real short-term T-bill, that's as close as you get to something that is perfectly riskless. The government will pay you back. It will pay you back. If it runs out of money, it'll just print money through the Federal Reserve. If the Federal Reserve says no, well, hell, we'll just invade another damn country. You will get your money back. As some of you know, I'm a writer on economics and finance and things like that, and I'm constantly having these people writing to me, do you think the government's going to default on debt? I think it is. Oh, you stupid asshole, shut up. No, they're not going to default. It is perfectly safe. As a matter of fact, in banking terms, they are virtually perfect substitutes, dollars and T-bills are, except for the liquidity aspect, slight liquidity difference. But look, expected inflation premium. That will be tacked on to the real interest rate to create the lowest observable rate, which for all practical purposes we call the risk-free rate. So if you ever see a formula, and you will in this class, that has R sub F in it, the risk-free rate, you will just, operationalize that and to apply it in a formula, you would just go look for the yield on a very short-term T-bill. What is the yield on a short-term T-bill? Historically, maybe 0.5, 1, 1.5, 2%, something like that. Interestingly, there have been several times when people in business people I know have actually asked me, they did calculations, they were acquiring T-bills, desperately acquiring T-bills, and once they did their calculations, they were finding in one case, one lady who worked for a large company here, her T-bill yield, the net T-bill yield at the end of her day came out negative 0.3%. And she contacted me and she said, I've done something wrong with my calculations. I'm getting a negative yield. What am I doing wrong? My Excel spreadsheets have gotten screwed up. I said, no, I think you're right. And I ran quickly through a couple of other people connected. And they said, yeah, it's coming out negative today. A risk-free rate. That means that with the inflation premium on it, it was negative, which means that the real rate of return was probably down around negative 0.5, negative 0.6%. That's weird. And I hope we get out of that soon because it makes for some really strange results in calculations. That R sub F is our starting point for any interest rate we'll see in the real world. For any interest rate we'd see in the real world, R sub F is the starting point. So we can effectively say This is the observable substrate. And then every interest rate builds from this. Every interest rate we see has R sub F underneath it. Any interest rate that would be paid on any instrument would have to pay at least the risk-free rate. Why? Because you could, as an alternative, invest in a T-bill. So if I wanted to borrow money from you. I needed $100. And the T-bill is yielding 1.2%. I'll pay you 1.2%. Don't say, look at me. For God's sake, I've lived a bad life. Don't trust my ass.
I'll go with the T-bill.
Yeah. So in order for me to induce you to lend me money instead of lending the government money by buying a T-bill from the government, I'm going to have to pay you more. I'm going to have to offer you a higher yield to compensate you for the risk that is involved in lending to me versus lending to the government. So every interest rate will be driven up and down by the ebb and flow of the T-bills, the risk-free rate. As it rises, all other interest rates will rise. As it settles, all other interest rates will settle with it. But that represents the competitive edge. And every other yield has got to have that in it, plus some more. And that's what we talk about next, is that plus some more. Before I do that, though, here's the deal. Expected inflation is a bitch. Because you see, it's not actual inflation. The creation of inflation is by the central bank. The central bank is the only place where inflation can be created. There is one and only one cause of inflation. That is a growth rate of the money supply in excess of the real growth rate of the economy. That's the only thing that can create inflation. Again, the only thing that can create inflation is the growth rate of the money supply exceeds the real growth rate of the economy, which uses that money. I'm going to give you some articles to read for over the next couple of days about the Federal Reserve. If the economy is growing at 2%, but the money supply is growing at 5%, inevitably, the economy can use only 2% of that growth. The other 3% will become inflation. It will. That's all there is to it. There is no if, and, or, and but about it. There's no magic. There's no hoping. There's no bullying the markets down. It will happen. Similarly, if the real growth rate of the economy is 3%, but the money supply is growing at 1%, you will inevitably create a deflation of 2%. It will happen. So, what would be the history recently in the last 8-9 years? Both at the same time, believe it or not. The Federal Reserve was growing M3 at an insanely fast rate, but it was growing the M1, the money that we used in the real economy, at a rate slower than the economy was growing. That's why we have this building inflation pressure at the same time you see deflationary pressures at the consumer level. Those won't last, trust me. Those will go away, and they already are. But at the end of the day, though, the inflation is created by the growth rate of the money supply exceeding the real growth rate of the economy. But here's the problem. It's not the inflation rate that will matter. It's the expected inflation rate. So if you have seen inflation go up and up, and up, year over year. It doesn't matter what the Federal Reserve promises, what the president promises, what the Congress promises. It does not matter. All that matters is the expectations of the market. And sometimes once inflation expectations become embedded, the worst thing in the world happens. Because then if the Federal Reserve does really crush the money supply, the expected inflation premium stays for a while. And that's a nasty thing. Yes, it is. Let's look at a short-run scenario. I'm going to do a supply and demand dynamic. It's going to start with a static. Here's the money supply, and I'm going to be very generic here. Now, the price of money. You know what the rental rate of money is? The real interest rate. That's the rental rate of money. When you put money in the bank, they're renting it from you. They're not buying it from you. They're renting the money. They pay you an interest rate for it. So interest rates actually are the price of money. And the real interest rate, I keep wanting to write it R. This is a very short-run scenario where there's no inflation embedded. Okay? Now, here's a demand curve, and I'm going to draw it with a liquidity trap in it. A demand curve for money, assuming that you were all taught liquidity traps in your economics. You were taught liquidity traps, right? You are looking at me pig face blank. Dear God, you should have had me for that class. Never mind. Okay. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to intersect that with a supply curve of money. Now, in a very short run situation, the supply of money is a fixed amount. Supply of money. And we'll put that in supply one of money. And it is the interaction of the supply of money, this short run fixed supply of money, with the demand for money that establishes the real interest rate at a given point in time. Now, if the Federal Reserve wants to lower interest rates to stimulate the economy, to boost production, to get the jobs going again, it would logically increase the money supply. And if it does that from SM1 to SM2, lo and behold, the real interest rate will drop. Like that. The rental rate. As the supply increases, the price decreases. That's just plain old supply and demand dynamics. No question about it. You want to bring interest rates down? You just print money. That's what the Fed has been doing since last year. They got scared to death by the depth of the recession we were dropping into. And so they just started printing M1 money like there was no tomorrow, funding giant, massive federal government programs and all that kind of stuff, providing liquidity, putting liquidity into the banking system, which the banking system didn't use, unfortunately. But anyway, no big thing, okay? Here's the problem, though. You print more money than the economy. I'm going to do it. You print more money than the economy needs. What's the result? Starts with an I. I love it when you talk about it. Yes, inflation. Inflation is what happens. So the Fed is working against itself because, yes, it is bringing down the real interest rate, but ultimately it will create inflation by doing that if it grows faster than the real growth rate of the economy. So it prints money to bring down the real interest rate. That works in the short run, but sooner or later, inflation begins to set in. So look what happens over here. Case of real goes down in the short run. The expectation doesn't change for a little while, but then the inflation starts. And the expectation begins to build, pushing the second term upward. You see it? And then the Fed is in a bad position because it wanted interest rates to go down to stimulate the economy, but they're beginning to come back up again. So what does the Fed do? It prints more money. to get the real rate down again. That drops this guy down, so R sub F falls again. But it's creating more inflation. But more critically, it's embedding the expectation of inflation deeper into the economy. And so this thing goes up. And the Fed suddenly is in the position where interest rates are beginning to rise again. And that will kill off the economic recovery. So it just keeps printing money and printing money faster and faster and faster, trying to stop the spiral of the R sub F. But as it prints the money faster, it's driving the expectation of inflation even deeper into the economic mind of the investment community, of the labor markets, of the businesses. And ultimately, you have interest rates that can no longer be brought down by printing money because it's just, it gets to the point where you've got negative real interest rates and you're just creating more and more and more expectation of inflation. Has that ever happened? Absolutely. That was what we had done from the 60s through the 70s until the end of the 1970s when Jimmy Carter appointed a really nasty ass Federal Reserve chairman who said, enough of this. Enough of this. And he just crushed the money supply. He just brought that thing back. And of course, real interest rates went through the roof. But the expectation of inflation didn't go down right away because no one believed him. No one believed the government. Oh yeah, we got another Federal Reserve chairman who says he's going to get tough on inflation. Sure. So the expectation of inflation stayed huge. Real interest rates went through the roof. And so in 1980, you had mortgages going at home mortgages, 25%. Now, corporate bonds, 20, 25%, 30%. It was unbelievable. Of course, Jimmy Carter was kicked out of office, even though he was the one who actually appointed the chairman that stopped the nonsense. But that's the way history goes sometimes. But you see, it's that expectation. It's almost like this lock that keeps the risk-free rate from moving as just the Federal Reserve's monetary policy moves. And so we have to keep this in mind when we think about Federal Reserve policy. Yeah, I can say, well, the Federal Reserve has a very loose monetary policy right now. It's printing a lot of money. So we should see low interest rates. But only for a while, until inflation expectations begin to embed in the economy, and then those will go. Then that will go away. Those low interest rates will begin to disappear. Now, using that as backdrop, let's get down to the business of what creates an interest rate that you will see in a given market. Again, every interest rate out there begins with K sub F, the risk-free rate. Remembering in the back of your mind that K sub F comprises K sub real plus the expected inflation premium, which historically we write that as a pi superscript E, as the expectation of inflation. That's the expected inflation premium. Every interest rate you will ever see begins with K sub F, the risk-free rate, because a short-term government treasury instrument, which is completely safe, is a completely perfect substitute for any other investment. So all interest rates begin with the risk-free rate. Now let's move on from the risk-free rate and let's see what's going on with the rest of it. We now have to talk about what is called a risk structure of interest rates. Risk structure. The first part of the risk structure is a default premium. And I'll write that as a K sub D, a default premium. This is a reward for the risk that some or all of the cash flow claim will not be satisfied. It is a reward for the risk that some or all of the cash flow claim will not be satisfied. So an investor putting money into any instrument must assess the possibility that either part of what he was expecting to get back or all of what he was expecting to get back won't come back to him. So, if we were to talk about different kinds of instruments and this default premium, let's try a couple of different things. What about a home mortgage? Does that have a high default premium or a low default premium in the interest rate charged? Just say it.
Low.
It does. Three reasons. One, there's a hard asset backing the promissory note, the home. Two, unless the loan-to-value ratio is below 80%, there is mortgage insurance on it. Three, most home loans are guaranteed by some agency of the federal government, like FHA or VA. So there is very little chance that an investor is going to take an ass bath on the investment in this. Okay? So that means that the default premium on a loan, a home loan, is going to be very low. On the other hand, you got any credit cards?
Yes.
Okay, now I used to until they got smart and they stopped giving. You see, because the credit cards are not collateralized, and so that means that clearly a default is quite easy. I mean, default, that's, you know, there's a trash can. There's, you know, Bill, trash can. Let's introduce each other. You see, that would mean that you would expect a high default premium on a credit card. So, which do you see? Lower interest rates, home loans or credit cards? Home loans have lower interest rates, largely because the default premium on a home loan is very low. The default premium on a credit card is higher. So there you go. Now, what about some other intermediate instruments? What about car loans? Would they have a high or a low default premium? Car loan. It's intermediate. Because on the one hand, you've got a hard asset. But on the other hand, remember that that hard asset loses a lot of value for a new car right off the lot. So that would mean that, especially in the early life of the loan, there is a better chance of losing some money if the person defaults on it. Because even if you get the asset back, you're not going to get enough to pay off the loan if you're the bank. So it's a mixed bag. So you should see an intermediate default premium. But wait a minute. Have you seen these ads on TV? 1.99% interest on a car loan. 0.99% interest on a car loan. No interest on your car loan. What's that all about? Why are you hearing such low interest rate if there's an intermediate default premium? Oh, it's... Well, there's something easier, yeah. They're just putting it the premium. They're hiding it in the price of the car. That's all they're doing. I mean, the reality is that if you think financially, no, they're not charging you 0.99%. Even if they say that, clearly the default premium is not consistent with 0.99%. Don't give me that. Don't blow smoke up my butt and tell me you're having a barbecue behind me in my honor. Really? And you can quote me on that, damn it. Okay. Where the hell was I? Okay. Student loan. High or low default premium?
Low.
Government guarantees it. And then the government will hunt your ass down and beat you with a rake if you don't pay it. Okay? So, it, really. But at the same time, That $100 loan, who was it? You were the sucker, or the lady. $100. I'll pay you 1% interest. I'll give you $101 back in a year. Okay, fine. 1.5%. And you're still looking at me. Wait a minute, what kind of grade am I going to get in here? No, clearly there's a default premium, especially on any kind of a promissory note. Now, remember what I said about different kinds of debt instruments? I was talking about things like high-grade commercial paper. Now, that's a short-term loan, 30 days. Now, the very, very financially creditworthy company, Microsoft, needs to borrow $10 million for 30 days. I need to borrow $10 million for 30 days. So which one is going to, would you expect a higher interest rate from? Microsoft or me?
Microsoft.
That you want a higher interest rate from Microsoft than me?
Higher.
Well, yeah, because my ass will default. I promise you right now, I will default. I will. Guaranteed, I'm going to default on that thing. Okay, you see, so commercial paper, you would expect, even though it's just a purely promissory note, there's no hard asset backing. These are companies that have been around, they have established high creditworthy status, so there will be a very low default premium assessed to them. How about municipal? How about municipal bonds, the bonds that are issued by cities? Would those have high or low default premiums on them? Here's the trick. What would you say in your judgment for a city that issues a bond? Are they
very low?
Because they'll just tax the hell out of their citizens if they need to pay it back. Interestingly, though, some years back, some big cities did default on munis, and all municipal bond prices, bond yields started to rise simply because the investment community saw that, oh my, cities can default. So there was a little more evidence, and the expectation changed a little bit, that no, it's not the case that cities will always pay their bonds back. It's possible that they might not. So for a long time after that, you did see a little more default premium in all city bonds, munis, or certainly in a lot of munis. Okay, now let me take you to the next one. Here's an oddball that's kind of nasty. Follow with me when I do this one. Okay. Before I write this one down, I'm going to try to play this one a little bit with you. Find some Victor or some student I haven't bothered for a while yet. Okay. Work with me here for a minute. Okay. You're going to lend me money. Now, the prevailing interest rate environment adjusted for risk for a loan to me is, let's say, 10%. Okay, so I'm going to need that money for, let's say, I need to borrow $100 for, let's say, a year. Now, in a year, interest rates could change, but not as much as if I wanted the money for 10 years. You see, suppose that I want that money for 10 years, and I'll pay you 10% a year, pay you $100, I'll pay you $10 every year for 10 years. Now, what would happen if over 10 years interest rates fell to 5%? What am I going to do?
Well, I would lose money.
Well, you would, but actually, you're making money. Because I'm paying you 10%, but interest rates for loans like mine has gone down to 5%. Yeah, you see. Yeah, okay. Now, what am I going to do? Am I going to just keep paying you 10% every year? Oh, hell no, noob. I'm going to refi. I'm going to give you back your money, and then you're stuck having to lend it back at 5%. What if interest rates go up to 15%? Wouldn't it be nice if you had your $100 so you could lend it to someone at 15%? Do you think I'm going to give you back pay that loan off early? No, you're married to me. Let's cut the cake and toss the flowers. You see, I'm going to stick with you for the life of that loan because interest rates have gone up 15%. Do you see how, as the length, the maturity of a loan expands, there is more chance on both the up and downside for you to get screwed? So, you're going to expect, for longer and longer lengths of loans, you're going to expect a reward. To take into account the up and down disadvantage to you of that loan. Because I can guarantee you that in 1 year, interest rates can move around. But in 10 years, I guarantee you they'll move around. 20 years, they're going to definitely move around. And either way they go, you lending money to me puts you at a disadvantage. If interest rates go down, I'll refi, give you back your money. If interest rates go up, I'll stay with you even though you would really love to have that money back so you could lend it to someone else at a higher interest rate. Therefore, all interest rates will carry a maturity premium. R of K. R K sub M. This is the maturity premium. It's the reward for the risk of extended investment. So you would expect the maturity premium to be higher for long-term instruments than for short-term instruments. And sure enough, you will see that. You get a home loan for 20 years, you'll get a better rate than if you get a home loan for 30 years. Bonds, if they are equivalent risk value, a shorter-term bond will have a lower interest rate than a longer-term bond will. Look at car loans. Even with car loans, you borrow the money for 3 years, you'll get a better interest rate than if you borrow the money for 5 years. That's the maturity premium showing itself to us. Now, interestingly enough, there's a story behind the maturity premium. And we can look at this maturity premium, and also, unfortunately, there's an inflation part to it too. But we can look at what's called a yield curve, and I'm sure some of you have seen a yield curve. They talk about it in chapter 2 in the book. And I strongly encourage you to have a look at some yield curves. Because a yield curve essentially, well, not essentially, all a yield curve does is take the yield on government debt instruments against the time to maturity of those instruments. So I can, in other words, I'd say, well, here'd be a 3-month T-bill yield. Here'd be a 6-month, a 9-month, a 12-month, a 5-year, a 10-year, etc. out. Now, they do a weird thing with this horizontal axis so they can compress it like a logarithmic scale. But the upshot is that what we look at is this, the arc of the yield curve. Now, it tells us something about the expected inflation premium that's being embedded by markets trading in these instruments. But it also tells us about the maturity premium. See, we expect that there will be a maturity premium representing risk of interest rate volatility as you go out on farther in maturity. What we're also interested in, though, is the arc of the yield curve. Is it relatively flat? Is it steep? That tells us some information about what markets are expecting concerning uncertainty about volatility in interest rates. Because if I am thinking interest rates could swing wildly over the next 5 years, I'm going to want a big maturity premium. But if I expect that interest rates are going to stay relatively stable, at least in my judgment, I wouldn't have a very high maturity premium. So if I see that a yield curve arcing upward like that, real steeply, that worries me because it tells me, one, that there's an expectation of inflation being embedded out there. That worries me. But it also tells me that there's also a lot of uncertainty in the investment community's herd judgment about where interest rates are going to be long term, way out there. Now, there's an interesting phenomenon, and I've written about this actually several articles, and I use this. There's sometimes the yield curve should have a nice smooth rise to it. And we can watch over time. There's some wonderful websites where you can actually see the yield curve. You can actually, there's one site, and I wish I could remember what it is right now, but you can say, show me what the yield curve has done over the past 6 months, 12 months. And you can actually see this flash animation of the movement of the yield curve. It's a very cool thing because it gives you a sense, I'm looking at herd thinking of a global community about interest rates and volatility of interest rates and expectations of inflation. One of the interesting things is that we expect a nice arc like this. And as I had written in an article, a couple of articles recently, the yield curve had been a little troubling. Its arc was pretty steep. But then, interestingly enough, that arc got kind of flat, which scared the hell out of me, and I'll tell you why in a minute. Then about, I don't know, I wrote this for Examiner, in an article for Examiner.com, just about a month, 2 months ago, the yield curve began to stabilize in this really nice, nice profile. And that gave me the idea, that's a good sign for the economy. The investment community is becoming certain, more certain about inflation going out and about volatility of interest rates. That's cool stuff. That indicated we're going to have a good recovery. Here's what can scare the crap out of you, though. This is a normal yield curve. Upward sloping, nice, pretty arc, not too steep, not too flat. Here is the nasty little bitch. It's called an inverted yield curve. Every recession has been forewarned by an inverted yield curve. Unfortunately, sometimes the yield curve inverts, but there's not a recession afterwards. So it's not a perfect predictor of recessions. But during the period from about 2005 until 2008, I was writing about the yield curve, watching it. It kept getting close to inversion, but it didn't invert. And then in 2007, it did a technical inversion. Just for a couple of days, and then it recovered again. Of course, the Fed was just pouring money in, trying to stop a recession until Bush got out of office. Trying. That was literally what you could just see the Fed was just like shoveling money, but it was shoveling M3 money. It was still choking off M1. No question, that's recession. I called the recession. I said, we're going to have a recession. I'm not sure when, but we are going to have a recession, and it's going to be, in technical terms, a mofo, okay? Well, I'll be darned. I was right. You know what? I have predicted 8 of the last 5 recessions. Who's good? I'm good. Yeah. But it wasn't just the yield curve inverting. There were so many warning signs. I've got an article series that I will have you read later called The Economics of Wreckage. Before the recession hit, I was just saying, here are all the disastrous numbers. Look at them. We're going to have a really bad recession. And the yield curve inverting was more not proof. It's certainly not proof. It was just one more warning sign. It's going to be bad. We're going to get a recession. Now, so what is the bottom line for you as a practical consequence for a course like this and for your investment lives? Yield curves are not just something for fancy investment people to look at. Watch the yield curve. It's worth keeping an eye on the yield curve to know, because a high steeping arc is usually a sign of expectations of inflation beginning to embed. Watch the yield curve for that in the near future, because there will be a very bad inflation. And you watch that yield curve to see as it begins to rise like that, almost like some kind of a dragon coming out of the water, ready to strike. That is the sign that the expectation of inflation is about to become realized in the prices that you see. And that should advise you about your wages, your consumption habits, and your investments. And also watch for the inversion of the yield curve. There is a slight possibility that we could have a recession down the road if the Federal Reserve gets too scared by the inflation and starts to crack down, or if the Federal Reserve becomes politicized as it has in the past, as it did under Alan Greenspan in 2000. If the Fed becomes politicized in the late 1990s and in the election year, if the Fed becomes politicized, it will clamp down on the money supply, and you could very well see the inversion of the yield curve again. Now, there's one last premium here in the interest rates that you see. I haven't bothered this side of the room nearly enough. Okay. Oh, I got to get something here. Can I borrow a piece of paper with you? Yeah, I need a piece of paper here. Okay, now. Yeah, okay. You, madam, you look like you're a woman of wealth and means. Now, there's a focus woman.
Okay.
Now, there's this handsome, wealthy, fine, upstanding Presbyterian stud who wants to borrow $100 from you. And I, a street bum, would also like to borrow $100. But we're obviously not going to get $100. We'll both promise to pay you back $100 in a year. He has his family's law firm draw up a promissory note. Wherefore, I am borrowing money from you, and I shall pay you in exactly 1 year $100. And all the fancy things. Okay. And it gives you this nice parchment. You know that you can actually sell that to someone else if you need your money back, okay? So, I come up to you too, and he's going to pay you back $100 in a year? Well, I'll pay you back $100 in a year too. He's got that fancy schmancy piece of paper here. I'm going to write on this. This is some toilet paper here. I owe you $100. Yeah, there's your damn promissory note right there. I'll sign it. What the hell's my name? I shouldn't have drunk that stuff last night, whatever the hell it was. Really, you know how it is. Yeah. So, he's given you a nice piece of paper, legal document, all the representations, witnesses, and I've given you this. Okay, now, each of us will pay you back $100 in a year. If you lend him $90 today to get $100 back, will you lend me $90? More than 90 or less than 90?
I wouldn't give you any money.
Oh, yeah, fine. Friggin' da. You'll give me $5 or something like that. Obviously, you will lend him more than you will on a fixed face value. So, as the price of the debt instrument goes up, what's happening to the yield of it? Do you remember that from last time? Price goes up, yield goes down. So, because you're giving him a price of $90, his yield, the yield to you, will be lower than the yield to me when you give me $5. That's an illiquidity premium. You can't get rid of this piece of paper. If you needed money real fast, you could sell his piece of paper to someone else. You can't sell this on eBay. Okay, well, you might. You can buy... Don't get me started on eBay. I'm such an eBay slut. The last one here is the illiquidity premium. And all that represents is the difficulty with which you could unload the debt instrument if you needed the money. I was a penny stockbroker. Do you know how hard it was for those sorry asses who bought stock for me to sell it again? I had them. They buy stock in some little tiny corporation. There was no market if they wanted to sell it. That's why the prices were penny. That's why they call it penny stock. Prices were low, yield expectation high. Let that be a lesson to you. Don't lend money from me and don't ever buy stock from me. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.